Hey there, listeners. This is Jonathan Tepperman, Foreign Policy's editor-at-large, and this is Foreign Policy Playlist. So as you may know, this is a podcast about podcasts. Each week, what I try to do is help you sort through the huge number of other podcasts out there by finding and recommending one show from somewhere around the world I think is worth listening to. Today, we're featuring the Iran podcast. As the name suggests, this series, which was created and is hosted by Nigar Mortazavi, an independent journalist, focuses on, well, Iran. What Nigar does really well is get beyond the headlines and the media's constant focus on security issues to find other, less bomb-centric ways to discuss the Islamic Republic. In the episode we're featuring today, for example, she talks to Houman Majd, another Iranian-American journalist, about his experiences in both countries, Iran and the US, and what it's like trying to report on and write about his homeland as a dual national. That episode was called The Ayatollahs No Longer Differ and was first aired November 28th. I'm going to play it for you in a few minutes. Before I do, though, here's a short conversation I recently had with Nigar about the series. Nigar, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me. So let me start with the question about the origin story, which is something that I always ask. How did the Iran podcast come into being?
Well, part of the story is the pandemic story, like everyone else getting stuck at home and working from home and having a lot of time. But I've also been thinking about this as a project for a very long time because I feel like there was a gap or a void or a need, basically, for some long-form, deeper discussions on Iran that is missing from the mainstream media. As you know, it's always the nuclear program, and it's usually the 5-10 minute hit that people hear about. And it's also the usual suspects. There's a number of guests, experts, many of them actually not Iranian, who are always on mainstream media, and it's mostly about the nuclear program or the political fight between Iran and the US. I wanted to take the audience beyond, first of all, the usual topics, and also bring in younger voices, more Iranian voices. I try to bring a lot of women who can talk about these topics in a longer form, not having to worry about the 2-minute TV deadline, and also to bring in these other topics that are of interest to the mainstream discussions on Iran.
If you could say a little bit more about the similarities and differences between the media in Iran and the United States. Now, there's a very obvious difference, which is that there's state censorship in Iran and there isn't in the United States. But I'm curious whether there are actually similarities despite that fact.
There's this famous saying among Iranian journalists that there is freedom of speech in Iran, but there's no freedom after speech. So there's a lot of things that are said, you just get into trouble for them later. You might end up, you know, being arrested or in jail. So, but what I want to be fair to Iranian journalists and the Iranian media, they have been pushing the boundaries of the censorship, the red lines, as we call it, very much, putting themselves in a lot of trouble, doing a lot of work that is considered just normal journalism here in the US. It actually takes a lot of courage. People can get in jail for tweets, but they still tweet them. They still write them. They still put themselves in that risk. So in that sense, I have a lot of respect for anyone who does serious journalism in Iran. And then as far as similarities, I think there's one similarity between the media in Iran and the media in the US is the misperception about the other. The lack of access that American journalists have in Iran is very similar to the lack of access for Iranian journalists who can't come to the US. And also the politics between the two countries that has really overshadowed media coverage and affected it. The topics they cover, the way they have to cover it, and just the look on the other side is very much affected by the 4 decades political animosity.
So given that lack of access, what do you think is the biggest thing that Americans get wrong about Iran these days and that Iranians get wrong about the United States?
Iran as a country, state, nation is a monolith. I think that's the most common sense that you get, even people who are looking for nuance. And that's actually one thing that I'm trying to bring with these longer conversations is nuance, not necessarily a lot of new information, but nuance. I think there's this lack of nuance and assuming that all there's one regime as if it's one person. That's the entire political system, and also the differentiation between Iranian society and the system, and also the gaps within the Iranian society. I think in general, what I want to say is that Iranians have more material and more access to cultural products about America to understand the nuances and the differences than Americans have about Iran, because there's a lot of products about Iran and material, but it's all in Farsi or Persian, mm-hmm. and if it's not translated into English, it's hard for Americans to access.
So this is not a question strictly about the podcast, but since I have you, I have to ask, how optimistic or pessimistic are you about the prospects of a new nuclear deal or a return to the existing nuclear deal?
I try to think of myself as an optimistic person, and I still have hope that this would happen just because I think it's so easy because the deal already exists. They just literally have to sit back at the table together. But I have to be honest, I expected this to happen much faster and simpler, and it seems like not the technicality and the logistics, but the political capital that both sides need to spend is a lot, is entangled in their domestic fights, and it's just taking time. And that delay is worrying me because it's another one of those instances that the window of opportunity is closing soon. So hopefully they'll do it sooner than later.
Why do you say it's closing soon? What will happen if they don't move fast?
Because there is a presidential election happening in June in Iran, this administration will change. It's very likely a hardline administration would come, and that could bring us back to the cycle of the Mahmoud Ahmadinejad on one side mm-hmm. and the Obama team on this side, the two sides trying to meet or trying to talk, but never moving any further than just the negotiating table. And that could bring them to an impasse for the rest of Joe Biden's one or even two-term mm-hmm. presidency with a hardline president in Iran.
Nigar Mortazavi, host of the Iran podcast, thank you so much for talking.
Thanks, Jonathan.
And that was Nigar Mortazavi. Now here's the episode we promised. The Ayatollahs no longer differ.
Hello and welcome to the Iran Podcast. I'm Nigar Mortazavi in Washington, D.C. In this episode, we discuss U.S.-Iran tensions from the unique perspective of an Iranian-American journalist and author who understands and explains both countries very well. My guest today is Houman Majd, an Iranian-American author and journalist based in New York. He has written three important books on Iran, The Ayatollah Begs to Differ, The Ayatollah's Democracy, and The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Not Stay. Houman, welcome to the Iran Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being with me. Let's start from, I know you were born in Tehran, Iran, to a diplomatic
yes.
family, and then raised and educated in the West, attended school in London, college in Washington, D.C. Let's talk about, let's start from the beginning a little bit, and how that upbringing went for you in a diplomatic family and then coincided with the Iranian Revolution at some point.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was born in Iran, as I've said in other interviews, but unfortunately never really raised there and never was schooled there, which is why my Persian language skills are not as good as they should be. As with most Iranian families, if you live outside the country, your parents, you know, will speak to you in Persian and you'll reply to them in English if you're going to American schools or English schools. So I can speak Persian. I do speak Persian and it's relatively accentless, but I'm sometimes shy to speak it among Iranians because I don't intentionally do this, but English words find their way into my conversation. Mm-hmm. And I find that embarrassing. I wish I could speak it fluently without ever using an English word.
That's the case for all of us.
Yeah.
I grew up in Iran, spoke Persian, but it still happens.
Yeah. And I think it's happening more and more now because so many more Iranians are in the diaspora than when I was growing up. There wasn't a diaspora when I was growing up. But yeah, for me, being in a diplomatic family, that's all I knew was to not have a home. For me, I was 8 months old when we left Tehran. So I, obviously I was a baby and not really cognizant of my surroundings. And so, you know, first to London for 3 years and then to San Francisco, where my dad was in the Iran had a consulate in San Francisco. Back then, San Francisco was way more important than Los Angeles. Los Angeles was kind of a backwater of California, but it was basically the entertainment business and a couple of big aerospace firms. But San Francisco was the kind of the heart of California. So that's where the consulate was. My dad was there. So I went to kindergarten in first grade, part of first grade in San Francisco, and then off to India, and then from India to Tehran for like a year, I think it was, or less than a year, like 8 months, where I went to the American school in Tehran because it didn't make sense if we're going to be there for less than a year to try to go to a Persian school and then have to learn Persian and reading and writing. So we just went to the American school there and then off to Tunisia and then to London again and then back to the States. So just growing up all over the place. And I thought that that was, you know, normal. That's what I wanted to do, which is why, you know, later on in life, when I was in college, I decided that actually I kind of want to be a diplomat because I can't imagine myself living in one place for the rest of my life. So I had planned to go back to Iran, learn how to read and write Persian, and then apply to the foreign ministry and try to, you know, get a job as a diplomat and a career as a diplomat. Unfortunately, or for me, unfortunately, but maybe for some other Iranians, not so unfortunately, the revolution interfered with that plan. So, I stayed at that point because my father was our ambassador, Iran's ambassador to Japan at the time of the revolution. And obviously he was recalled and for, you know, a number of years didn't go back to Iran based on advice from family who were in Iran and who had access to, you know, the revolutionary government. So he didn't go back for a while. And of course, myself and my brother and my sister didn't go back either. And long story short, here I am 42 years later. never thinking that I'd be living in one place for so long. And I've been in New York for, you know, 30 years.
Mm. You had this one episode and you talk about it in your last book, The Ministry of Guidance Invites You to Stay, where you tried to move back and live in Iran and wrote this book about it. Tell us about that episode with your wife, your baby, your child, basically, in that year that you spent in Iran.
Yeah, the year was interesting. I'd been going back and forth. I started going to Iran after my career in the music business and film business, and as a journalist. I started going back to Iran in the early 2000s when Khatami was president, and it was relatively open. It had become a relatively open society compared to, I would say, you know, certainly the past 30 years, the previous 30 years, and probably in some instances more open than the Ahmadinejad years, or even today with a sort of security state where, you know, dual citizens are very suspect. There were plenty of dual citizens who were able to go. I didn't have a passport, an updated passport for many years, but I got one under the Khatami, in the Khatami years, and I started going to Iran. And there was something very unfamiliar about Iran for me because I hadn't been there in 40 years. And there was something at the same time very familiar. I don't know, you know, when you're born somewhere, and, you know, the smells of that place sort of kind of lodge themselves in your deep memory. And when you're back there, you know, even if it's 40 or 50 years later, it's, you know, it's there. There was something very familiar about it at the same time as being unfamiliar. And I thought, you know, at my age, it would be really good for me to have that experience of not just dropping in for a couple of weeks and knowing that I'm leaving after a couple of weeks and having a good time. I mean, Iranian dual citizens used to, at least before all these arrests happened in Iran, have a good time, journalists included, going to Iran. I mean, you'd go to parties, you'd have meetings, you'd have interviews, and you really see the best of Iran in many ways. But I thought, I want to see the best of Iran. Sure, I've seen the best of Iran, but I also want to experience the worst of it without going to jail. I mean, that's the real worst of it, is ending up in jail. But I mean, seeing the worst, seeing what it feels like for people to work and live in a country. Of course, I was understood that I'm very privileged. I wasn't going to be living in a hovel. I wasn't going to be starving. I wasn't going to be not being able to afford to have, you know, diapers for my kid or Pampers for my kid, not being, you know what I mean? So I was living a privileged life. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, I would want to ride, I would ride the subway, ride the buses every day, you know, just try to be, live, go to the grocery store myself, you know, buy things off the street, try to live as I would assume most Iranians would say, a, you know, middle to upper class existence, because I'm not going to subject my family to, you know, trying to struggle to survive. So yes, I was privileged. And I did this with the knowledge that I was going to write a book about it. And this was going to be sort of a memoir, but also kind of trying to understand Iran and the dynamics in society and in the political sphere better than just dropping in for a couple of weeks or 3 weeks, writing some articles, or even, you know, preparing research for a book, to actually experience life there. And I think it was a great experience. It started to get a little uncomfortable toward the end of my stay there. So after about 9 months, you know, getting phone calls from, you know, unlisted numbers, which only government people can have, security services and government people, and kind of like a few warning shots, basically. So I decided that it wasn't worth staying much longer than that.
Mm-hmm. And this is in 2011, basically.
Yes.
Around 2 years after the Green Movement started. Let's talk about that episode for a little bit, the Green Movement, because a lot of things changed for the Islamic Republic, basically, after the events of 2009. How did that change your view of you know, contemporary Iran and the Islamic Republic and the post-revolution era?
I mean, it changed because I got a sense that there was a real, before 2009, before the election of 2009, which is probably one of the most exciting elections. I was there covering that election with Ann Curry for NBC News. Mm-hmm. We spent 2.5 weeks in Tehran and Isfahan, and just roaming around covering the whole election period and going to the rallies and going to even Khatami had a rally and things like that, and filming and made basically a documentary about it. It was an incredibly exciting time. And it felt like this is really kind of like this is Iran going through some major changes. If you thought Khatami's time was going to be moderate or even liberal, this is going to be 10 times that. It felt that way. And what happened with the election is, whether or not it was stolen, and most people think it was, but most people who, you know, examined it thought, if not stolen, there was some irregularities that should have been addressed. But I don't want to get into that, but the disappointment was, you know, very obvious, what happened. And then the securitization of society sort of happened after that. I mean, I think the Nizam, the system, the Islamic system, decided that after seeing 4 million people on the streets, similar to what happened during the Shah's time, and these are people who remember the Shah's ouster, and I remember it very well, you kind of sensed that this was something that was, you know, similar to that. And if this grew, it would definitely threaten the system. And I think that realizing that there are that many people, albeit people who are, you know, of the middle and upper classes more than the working classes, and people who are a little bit more comfortable and can afford to spend time on the streets and can afford to, you know, ask for change, because they're not busy trying to make a living for their family or put food on the table. Albeit that, they still sense that there's a danger to the system. There's some deep dissatisfaction if they think that their vote is going to be stolen. So you sense that security change in Iran. I sensed it right away the first time I went back. And I didn't go back after the election for, I guess, probably around 10 months, because there was still on, the movement was ongoing and there were still demonstrations and all that. And it was advisable for most people, or at least dual citizens who were involved in the media, to not go back. There was definitely this sort of suspicion of us. But I eventually did go back and wrote a long piece for Foreign Policy magazine. And, you know, I said that Iran is not a, it's not a security state in the sense that people think. There aren't people at the airport with submachine guns looking at you and all that. But, you know, it is, it has changed. There's definitely a change in the, in society. And I think that's continued until Rouhani was elected. I think there was a brief moment when Rouhani was elected that that felt that way a little bit. Although, as we know, that they continue to arrest dual citizens and particularly high profile ones. So since Rouhani's election, I've only been back twice, and actually both times in a very short period of time, right after he was elected to 2013, and then advised not to go back anymore.
And basically the Green Movement was the most serious challenge to the foundation of the Islamic Republic since the time of the revolution. And it had this, brought this perception of an imminent collapse of the regime, or, you know, this idea of regime change that many in the diaspora exiles have had for decades, since the beginning of the Islamic Republic. But it's already been 10 years and the imminent collapse of the regime hasn't happened. We still see protests. The protests are massive. Last November was one, the year before that. But what do you think about that, this perception that every time there are mass protests, that are, they're interpreted by some as the imminent collapse?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to see why, because, I mean, you compare it to, let's say, the Arab Spring, or you compare it to Egypt. I mean, mass protests bring about a collapse, and there's an alternative. I think what's happened with Iran, and this is for the, you know, benefit of the regime, I guess, is that there isn't a central kind of opposition that shows itself to be an alternative that people can latch onto. Even with the Green Movement, it was like, you know, you guys tell us to come out and vote. You say that we're an Islamic democracy. That's what you call yourselves. And when we do vote, you steal our election. So what's the point? Why should we vote if you're going to do that? And there was just a real disappointment that didn't feel like Mousavi or Karoubi were saying, we're, you know, down with the Islamic Republic, we're going to create a secular republic, or we're going to create an Islamic Republic that's completely different. There's not going to be a supreme leader. There's not going to be expediency council. There's not going to be, do you know what I mean? There was none of that. And then the people outside the country, if it's the MEK or the monarchists or some other regime change groups, I mean, they don't seem to have any ability to garner real support among the population in Iran. And there is a big difference between, at least from my perspective in looking at it, because I was old enough, unfortunately, to have seen the Islamic Revolution from afar. I was in DC at the time, but you know, you saw it every day. It was a big news. It was big news in America on television. You saw it, the headlines in the papers every day, deep reporting, 60 Minutes, you know. But the big difference was the Shah may have been popular among the upper middle class, people who benefited from that kind of regime, but there was no loyalty per se. And with the Islamic Republic, there is a loyalty among a segment of the population. And it's not an insignificant segment. It may be, I don't know what it is. It might be 30%, it might be 25%, it might be 50%. But it's, the loyalty is there because of religion. And when you religion is a very strong, I mean, you know, it's a very, very strong motivation. And that loyalty has prevented the kind of collapse that you would have expected if it had been, for example, if Iran had a monarchy and had 4 million people come to the street, and then another 2 million or another 4 million, or, you know, that kind of, a monarchy would collapse much more quickly unless it was such a beloved monarchy. But there's, you know, very few monarchies that have that kind of ideological loyalty. anymore. Perhaps, you know, previous centuries they did, but and now it's not practical. So this is an advantage that the Islamic Republic has, and it's something that is, you know, for people who advocate regime change is probably disappointing, but it's something that they should think about. The people who advocate regime change, it's you know, the structure of the opposition, which is based mostly outside Iran. And of course, there, you know, there's MEK people in Iran, there's monarchists in Iran, there's people who would love for the monarchy to find a way back to Iran and they could just, like, you know, live their lives the way they want to. But I don't see any real movement. I mean, we hear about the Saudi Arabia funding monarchists and funding the MEK and all that, or Israel doing the same thing. But I don't think either one of those countries really expects either one of those opposition groups, which are the two biggest, I suppose, or the two most, you know, popular, to have any success in Iran. So it's sort of like, you know, let's have a thorn in the side of the Islamic Republic, because they know and we know that neither one of these groups will actually ever be successful. But let's just make it uncomfortable for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the base of the supporters of the regime, and also the fact that they have the power, they have weapons, and, you know, the government is willing, the state is willing to repress and, you know, crack down on any kind
of... the state is willing to do that, but it's not always up to the state. Mm-hmm. You know, it's questionable whether the Shah... if he had listened to some of his generals and he had, you know, fired on way more demonstrators than they actually did fire on. And if the Shah had stayed and, you know, mowed down demonstrators in the way that other regimes have done, or even the Islamic Republic has done on some occasions, the question is whether the troops would have gone ahead with it. You know, it's very hard. You know, Ryszard Kapuscinski wrote a really great book at the time after the revolution. He was the Polish author and journalist who was based in Tehran for the revolution. And he was sent there by a Polish television or a Polish newspaper. At the time, Poland was communist. But anyway, he wrote this thing. And in that book, he talks about one episode where there's a huge demonstration. And he's looking at a young soldier, a conscript, who lifts his rifle to shoot and then slowly puts it down. And he says that that's when I knew that the revolution was going to be successful. You can tell a soldier to shoot, but if he doesn't shoot, there's not much you can do about it. And we haven't had that. I mean, we've had, the Islamic Republic has a loyal base, which it can rely on, which is not the Artesh. It's to some extent the Revolutionary Guard, but not even the Revolutionary Guard completely. It's more the Basij. And that's a very particular, you know, cadre of people that they have cultivated, the regime has cultivated, to be the guardians of the revolution in a way. The Islamic Revolutionary Guards are the guardians of the revolution. The Basij are the shock troops, as it were. They're the ones on those motorcycles. So I think that they are unlikely to disobey orders. Mm-hmm. You know, in 2011, I was there for the anniversary of the Green Movement. So it was 2 years after. And I was on Valia Street. And I was going to go and try to take a bus. And there was probably 1,000 motorcycle guys on with these black helmets and, you know, black body armor kind of things. And I was crossing the street and one guy came zooming right up to me. I thought, oh, God, he's going to, like, beat me or something. And I said, what is it? And he just lifted his visor off his helmet. He said, oh, nothing. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you. But I obviously wasn't the kind of person that he was looking for or was going to go after. And there wasn't even a demonstration yet, but it was near Van Ack. And so, but those shock troops are perfectly willing to, you know, do anything basically to keep the power in the hands of the regime.
So let's fast forward a little bit to the nuclear negotiations. I know I was there, you were there, we're observing what was happening. It was truly historic, basically. Iran and the United States, after 3 decades, sitting down publicly at the table, talking, and eventually agreeing on something.
Yes.
And then that deal didn't have much time to live until Donald Trump came in and he basically tried to kill it. It's still alive on life support, as some say, but it's in pretty bad condition.
Yes.
And now we're at this point of right now, Donald Trump's administration leaving soon and a new administration, Joe Biden, coming in. Do you think that the next administration, Joe Biden's administration, has enough time and the political capital to return to the JCPOA and basically resume, pick up things where they left off 4 years ago?
Well, there's very little time, but I think, you know, if there's a will, yes. I don't know about political capital yet. I don't think Biden knows that yet. I think after Georgia has a runoff election for the two senators, it'll be clearer if it's possible for the Senate to be controlled by the Democrats. If the House and the Senate and the executive branch are controlled by the Democrats, I think, you know, he might feel like he's got political capital to do things that might not ordinarily be feasible politically. But there will be pressure. There's Democratic hawks, as we know. You know, Chuck mm-hmm. Schumer in the Senate was against the deal. Even when, I mean, he is a Democrat, but he was against Obama's. He voted against it. Mm-hmm. Menendez of New Jersey, Senator Menendez, again, Democrat, voted against it. These voices, and these are powerful voices, especially Chuck Schumer, in the party. And people like Chuck Schumer are going to be hesitant to advise Biden to jump in when they'll say, yeah, we disagree with Trump. This maximum pressure is all, you know, dumb because it hasn't done anything. In fact, if anything, it's made Iran more dangerous and more powerful in the region. So we disagree with all that. But why would we give up the leverage that Trump has created for us? Unintentionally, perhaps, but was created for us. We all know the real is, you know, in free fall, basically, or has lost whatever 70% of its value since Trump withdrew from the deal. You know, the economy is suffering. They're exporting at best less than 1 million barrels a day at best, which is, you know, 1/3 of what they were exporting at best again. Mm-hmm. So they have no access to their foreign exchange. So why would we give that all up and go right back and lift all the sanctions and, you know, they can go back to their bad behavior? And there's this thing in America, and I think it's, you know, bipartisan. This is not Trump and it's not, you know, Biden. Everybody calls Iran's behavior bad. You have yet to come across, I mean, Anthony Blinken, who's the new Secretary of State, everybody who says, always, you know, they always qualify Iran's bad behavior. And this is something that the Iranians object to, of course, because, you know, when you talk about bad behavior, let's talk about, you know, Saudi Arabia and attacking Yemen. Let's talk about, you know, butchering Khashoggi in the Istanbul consulate. Let's talk about bad behavior, you know, everywhere in the region. And there is, of course, there's bad behavior. There's bad behavior by the U.S. And has been bad behavior by the U.S. So it's kind of a thing that's thrown out there. But if there's a will, if Biden wants to really bring Iran back to compliance with the JCPOA, which he will then be able to say, look, when I took office and Trump had left the White House, Iran was 3 months or 2 months away from a nuclear bomb if they chose to make a dash for it. Mm-hmm. Now, with them back in compliance, we're back to being more than a year. It buys us time. So, you know, he could rationalize things. I mean, if you want to rationalize things to the American public, you can. You could say, yeah, we'll deal with Iran's bad behavior later, but let's first get this 2 month, you know, breakout time, which is another red herring, but it's there nonetheless. It's in the narrative about the Iranian nuclear deal. Mm-hmm. Let's get that 2 month breakout time down to back up to over a year, which is what we did in the Obama administration. Again, you know, there's going to be all kinds of different advisors telling him what to do. But between, you know, he takes office at the end of January, then Iran has Nowruz. We have our new year where Iran shuts down basically for 3 weeks. And then immediately after that, it's the presidential campaign in Iran. In June, there's a new president elect. And August, the new president takes office. So between January 20th and, I would say, April, it's not a whole lot of time. not a whole lot of time. But if he wants to join the JCPOA, I don't see a reason why. I mean, I'm pretty sure that Iran would welcome it. Why wouldn't they? Because if by rejoining the JCPOA, if he also lifts sanctions, then why wouldn't they? You know, why wouldn't the Iranian government welcome that? They would. Rouhani has mm-hmm. made it clear that he would. Mm-hmm. They're talking about lifting all the sanctions, and that's a little complex because Trump has changed some of the nuclear-related sanctions, which were lifted under UN Resolution 2231, which codified into international law, mm-hmm. the JCPOA. Has changed some of those sanctions to be terror-related sanctions. So, you know, like, on, and then the specially designated, you know, people like Zarif, who's the foreign minister, or Zangane, who's the oil minister. I mean, those things are just, they'll have to be undone in order for Iran to feel like, you know, they're back to the JCPOA. And then, of course, Iran is probably going to, you know, try to strike a hard bargain in terms of any kind of guarantees by America. I don't think there's some talk of, oh, compensation for our losses, but, you know, I don't think the U.S. is, I don't think Iran even thinks that's a realistic goal to hold out for the U.S. to pay out of its own pocket billions of dollars to Iran for the losses Iran has suffered because of U.S. withdrawal. But I think, to make a long story short, it's possible, but it's not going to be easy. Not going to be easy as joining the Paris Climate Agreement, which is just an executive order. It's done. U.S. is back in.
Or the travel ban, which Biden has promised to.
Yeah, that'll be lifted with an executive. It was a preposterous ban, and, you know, even some Republicans thought it was preposterous. It's definitely racist, so, or bigoted. Mm-hmm. Some of those things will be, yeah, some of the immigration stuff, visas, travel ban. All that. Now, the travel ban is also now because of COVID, related partly to COVID. I mean, there's a travel ban on Europeans too. It's not just Iranians who can't come here. But, you know, assuming that the vaccine takes hold and is distributed, you know, by the middle of next year, travel ban should be, to all intents and purposes, you know, eliminated.
I think there's this understanding probably on both sides of the idea of leverage. It's, as you said, we hear from hawkish Democrats, even some of the hawkish circles in Europe, that Trump mm-hmm. sanctions and maximum pressure has provided this leverage for when Biden wants to return to the deal. And then it seems like the Iranians on their own side are now also coming up with their leverage, like you said, compensation for the damages done by Trump, and also asking for guarantees that the administration after Biden won't be able to again leave the deal. I mean, it sounds reasonable, but then at the same time, like you said, there's this golden window of opportunity that's a very short few months for Biden to rejoin. So how do you think these leverage points on both sides are complicating a return to the JCPOA, or is it just posturing and then?
No, I think it is complicating it. I mean, it is complicating it. I mean, one of the interesting things for me will be to see who's going to be the lead Iran czar. I mean, the climate czar is John Kerry, who was mm-hmm. the Iran point person before. Mm-hmm. I can't see Antony Blinken, you know, taking that role right away, because it's an intensive role, and he's going to be Secretary of State. He's got to fix the State Department. He's got to deal with China, Russia. He's got to deal with every country in the world, essentially. And Iran's going to be one of them, but it's going to have to be a Deputy Secretary of State. And who's going to have that file? Is it going to be Wendy Sherman? And Wendy knows Zarif, she knows Ravanchi, she knows Araghchi, she knows Hamid Bahidinejad. He knows them very well. They sat in negotiating rooms together for 2 years, you mm-hmm. know, at times for hours and hours on end. You remember, you'd be sitting in the lobby of the hotel waiting for eight hours to get some news from one of these people. So drinking endless $9 espressos, as I used to say. but so if it's someone like that, and there is and he or she has a mandate, go make a deal, it becomes a little bit more realistic to say it could probably be done. Also remember, Biden is, you know, going to be 78 years old. He's going to be, you know, one of the oldest presidents, or if not the oldest president in history to take office. He's had a very long career in politics. He's not corrupt. He's incorruptible. He will leave office with a very good legacy, a very good reputation. he's not going to really damage himself if he rejoins the JCPOA, something Obama did. One was popular, not just in among most Americans at the time, but across the world was a popular deal. Mm-hmm. So what's he's not thinking, oh, I'm going to be running for a second term and then I'm going to want to have this and that as my legacy and all this. It's like, why, you know, he can give the mandate to somebody to say, go make a deal and make it fast because we don't have a lot of time. We got to do this before the next president. We at least got to be in a position where, you know, even if we have to deal with the next president, that we're close to resolving this issue. And as I said, the breakout, I mean, his best, in my opinion, his best argument is that Iran is 10 months from, I'm sorry, 2 months or 3 months from a nuclear weapon. This is an emergency. This is what we were dealing with at the, you know, when we first started negotiating with them when Rouhani came in. It's like, they're at a breakout and they're doing 20% enrichment. Now they're not doing 20% now, but they've got advanced centrifuges. There's a lot of, I mean, the leverage for Iran is actually less about making demands. It's more about, yeah, okay, let's not make a deal. We've survived 4 years of maximum pressure. Fine. We'll just keep building up a stockpile. We'll keep doing more advanced centrifuges. We'll keep building our underground facilities. Mm-hmm. Fine. You know, we're not afraid. You don't want to deal with us? Fine. You know, so I think that they have leverage. Iran has leverage too, in many ways, in that sense, in the sense that this is something that, you know, and you know, people talk about, you know, Israel might bomb Iran if, or US might bomb Iran if there's a sense that, you know, the breakout time is down to a month or 3 weeks, or if there's some suspicion that they might be developing a nuclear weapon. Yeah, but, you know, everyone knows there's a reason why Israel hasn't bombed Iran. There's a reason why the U.S. hasn't bombed Iran. This is not Syria. This is not Iraq. It's a completely different kettle of fish. And I think everybody recognizes that, and especially the incoming Biden administration recognizes that. I mean, these are professionals. You may or may not like them, but they are professionals. Mm-hmm. And they know what they're doing, and they know Iran. Jake Sullivan, who's going to be the national security advisor, you know, was one of the negotiators for the U.S., at least in the initial stages.
Mm-hmm. Well, now that you bring that up, we just saw a report from Israel saying that Israeli military is preparing or is on high alert for a potential strike by the Trump administration on Iran in the last 2 months. You talked about the Biden administration and how they see mm-hmm. things. But what do you think about this outgoing admin, this Trump who has lost the election the next 2 months, and then this basically reading from Israel of a potential strike on Iran?
Well, I think, I mean, it was reported by the New York Times that, you know, last week Trump asked for options to attack Iran. But asking for, I mean, of course Israel's going to be on high alert. I think, you know, Saudi Arabia's on high alert. The Emirates are on high alert. Everyone's on high alert right now in this period where you've got a completely unpredictable United States. Nothing is predictable about the United States at this point in this administration. The things that Trump has done have been unprecedented in the history of the United States. So being on high alert in terms of something could happen, yes, I think it's only natural. I'd be surprised if they weren't on high alert. What is it? I mean, because Israel knows that if the U.S. attacks Iran, Israel might get blamed. If it doesn't get blamed, the blowback will affect Israel. So, you know, they're going to be on high alert. But I think it's partly kind of like, you know, I don't know, you can call it a psychological war. I think these leaks from the government, Israeli government, or leaks from the U.S. government are just to put kind of pressure on Iran, I think, more than anything else. I don't think Trump has any intention of attacking Iran. I don't think he wants to leave office in a state of war. I don't think he wants to leave office with the potential of American soldiers being killed and him being blamed for that. I mean, right now, I mean, he's playing golf. He didn't attend the G20 summit. The G20 summit, which was about, in Saudi Arabia, the Saudis were hoping that, you know, Corona would be gone by now. They were hoping that this was going to be their big, you know, coming out party, you know, the G20 summit with all these heads of state going to Saudi Arabia. And, well, it ended up being a virtual summit, but it was on Saturday and Trump was playing golf and didn't bother to show up. And the whole point of the summit this year was how we're going to have a coordinated worldwide, you know, response to the virus and the vaccine and everything. And he couldn't even be bothered to attend that or pretend to attend it. You could actually pretend to attend it by, you know, not saying anything, but just putting a pair of headphones on. But instead, he played golf. So I think that's where Trump is. I think he's checked out. And I think that, you know, Pompeo and the Pentagon or anybody, they can't start a war. They'd have to have Trump approve it. And I just don't see Trump wanting to, you know, have even one American soldier killed because of him at this point. He wants to go off and do something else. And if he may want to run again. If he doesn't run again, he certainly wants to see Ivanka perhaps run. He's not going to do anything like that. I don't think so. I mean, of course, that said, who am I to say? I mean, I never thought he'd do the things he did in the last 4 years anyway, so he could do anything. Mm-hmm. But I think war is on a whole other level. You know, go back to the thing about, you know, the drone, when Iran shot down the drone and didn't retaliate, you know, 11 minutes or however many minutes it was before they were going to attack. It was like, oh, I'll call it off. He's not a very courageous man when it comes to that. He's not bold in that way. He's bold. He has bold rhetoric, but follow through isn't very good.
Okay, I want to go back to the $9 espresso in the expensive European hotels. Yes. And basically the nuclear negotiations, because we know the incoming Biden administration, they will just be rejoining a deal that's already made. But back then, it was a deal in the making. And like I said, it's truly historic, even seen as a miracle by many people, observers, myself included, on both sides, that, okay, yes, negotiations were happening for about a decade, but to see an actual deal in real life was just very shocking. What do you think, and you have this amazing perspective on both sides, what do you think was that perfect recipe that brought the two sides to the table and resulted in that deal? Because everyone sees Iran as an irrational actor, like you said, a bad actor. Mm-hmm. And also no one thought the U.S. would, you know, eventually make concessions to a small country or a bad actor like Iran. But it did happen with the help of mm-hmm. Europeans, with the participation of the Chinese and Russians. But what do you think was that perfect recipe that made it happen? And I want to talk about this because the Biden administration will be rejoining the deal, but they're also looking into the future for more negotiations and more potential deals. So what was that perfect recipe back then?
I think it's one word, or actually two words, Javad Zarif. I mean, I think that's you know, that's the recipe. You know, his time in America, and he had participated on a lower level in the negotiations in 2003 during the Bush administration, when Hassan Rouhani was the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, and therefore, by definition, under Iran's rules back then, by definition, the chief nuclear negotiator. So, but Zarif was the UN ambassador, and his role as UN, because of his English and because of living in America and having, you know, gone to high school and university here and everything, it's like, oh, well, naturally, he's a diplomat that we were going to use in the negotiations. But this time, he was in charge of the negotiations. He had a mandate. He had a mandate from the supreme leader, who trusts him, by all accounts, likes him, understands his value to Iran. And, you know, John Kerry, I think, you know, you could put him as an asterisk in terms of the perfect recipe. John Kerry, going back to his days in Vietnam or post-Vietnam, has been someone who's been all about peace and not about conflict, and had met Zarif many, many times as a senator, as Iranian diplomats in America, and they're only in New York, can meet with Americans who aren't in the executive branch. Even at times when it was banned for an American official to meet with an Iranian official, senators and Congress persons are obviously exempt from that. They don't take instructions from the executive branch. So he'd met in the same way that Zarif has met with Biden many times throughout his career. It's natural. If John Kerry would ask the Iranian ambassador to the UN, "I'd like to come and see you. I'm going to be in New York." Of course, you're going to, you know, accept that invitation or ask him to come and see you. So that was the recipe. And I think that you kind of need that rapport between two people who can understand where the other is coming from, even if they disagree with the other person, but can understand where, you know, the motivation is, and can and have a will to once and for all end this with this like greater goal of like, this is going to be a first step. Isn't this great? It's been, you know, 35 years since the revolution. You know, so many things have gone wrong in terms of the relationship between the US and Iran, or even the West and Iran. This is the opportunity, the first black president. You know, you've got John Kerry as Secretary of State now, who's not a hawk in the way that his predecessor, Hillary Clinton, was in terms of, you know, being a Democratic hawk in many ways. So that was really, I think, it. I mean, we saw that. It was criticized, as you know, by the media, hardline media, or the conservative media in Iran. You know, Zarif taking a walk on the by the lake in Geneva with Kerry. I mean, those are the ways you make diplomacy work. You know, if you sit across the room and just lecture each other, well, you're never going to get anywhere. And I think both sides knew that. I mean, under Jalili, before Zarif took over that file, nuclear file, the complaint by Americans was he just sit there and lecture America all the time. So it's not really a negotiation. And if we ever go back to that, nothing's going to happen. It's a good news that John Kerry is going to be in the administration, cabinet level, although not assigned to the nuclear file or not assigned to Iran in any way. But he's going to be there. He's had the experience. Wendy Sherman, I believe, is going to have some role based on the fact that she was advising the Biden administration. And she was, as we know, there all the time during the nuclear negotiations, and has very good rapport with Ravanchi and Arakchi, who, if they're negotiating again, they understand each other. You know, Ravanchi was educated in America as well and is very good English. Arakchi was not educated here, but he has gotten to know America very well because of those intense, or Americans very well because of those intense 2 years that they spent, in the same room together. So I think that, you know, it can happen. I mean, that it was proven that it could happen. I don't think anybody felt like they got away with something. Iran didn't get away with anything. And I think America didn't really get away with anything. It did what it said it was going to do. It said, you know, Obama and Kerry said they're going to, and Biden, they all said we're going to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. Pretty much the entire world agreed that that's what the JCPOA did in fact accomplish. It guaranteed. Iran always claims it's not seeking a nuclear weapon, but the JCPOA guaranteed that, you know, even if they're lying, they would be caught up. So yeah, again, the recipe is having a will to do it and having the right people doing the negotiating.
Well, on that note, Houman, I want to thank you for joining the Iran podcast.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you, Nega.
And that was the episode, The Ayatollahs No Longer Differ, from the Iran podcast. It was first aired on November 28th of last year. My thanks to Nigar for sharing the podcast with us. And that'll do it for this episode of Foreign Policy Playlist. If you like what you heard, please subscribe. If you want to suggest another great podcast we may not know about, please do. You can email me at podcasts@foreignpolicy.com. We're all ears. And for more information about FP Podcasts, please check out our website, foreignpolicy.com, or join our Facebook group. I'm Jonathan Tepperman, and I'll see you soon.